Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
You're listening to episode 14 of Why Are People Into That? A podcast for expanding your sexual imagination. I'm your host, Tina Horn, and my guest today is writer and porn star Connor Habib. On every episode of Why Are People Into That, which you can stream for free at whyarepeopleintothat.com or download from iTunes, on every episode, I sit down with an expert on human sexuality and we pick a subject they love to talk about and we explore why people love or obsessively desire that thing so much. We are exclusively sponsored by Smitten Kitten, who just sent me these fucking adorable stickers. One is a cat with a unicorn horn that says LGBTQIA per hide. And the other is a growling bear that says fierce, which is, it's just everything for me right now. So check out smittenkittenonline.com. So, this summer, I was at a gay writer's retreat in Los Angeles, like you do, and I stayed one extra day in the land of succulents and carnitas to go over to Connor Habib's house. And you know when you go to someone's house and they just have bookshelves everywhere you look? Books piled on the floor, a package containing new books on their front stoop, and you just want to kind of like roll around in their books. Anyway, that's the kind of creep I am, and that's the kind of library that Connor Habib has. Now, Connor is just one of the best sex worker writers out there, and besides writing about porn performer rights and sexual liberation, Connor is a student of the occult. Now listen, I lived in the Bay Area for 10 years, and I know some wingnuts and some motherfucking sorcerers, okay? And I want to believe, but I can also be a bit skeptical about this kind of thing, a little cynical about this kind of thing, but I will be goddamned if Connor does not make a completely cogent case for things like heart magic and anal sex as transubstantiation and why BDSM ritual threatens those in power. All stuff I'm really into, so you don't want to miss this one. So I want you to guzzle some love potion number 9 and levitate 3 feet off the ground while you listen to Why Are People Into the Occult? Right, Connor Habib. Here we are on your couch in sunny, beautiful Los Angeles.
Hi.
Hi. How are you?
I'm great. Yeah.
Cool. I'm a little spaced out. I just came back from a gay writer's retreat, but I started thinking about it a couple of days ago. If there's anybody that I could have a soft landing with from that experience, it would definitely be you.
All right. Awesome.
truth be told, I mostly stayed in LA one extra day so that I could podcast with you.
No
so.
Way.
Yeah.
Really?
Well, I'm gonna go karaoke tonight.
It's really about the karaoke.
It was you were a happy a part of that.
Awesome.
But I'm so happy that you're on the podcast. I know you as an amazing gay porn star and also as an incredible writer. I love people who have both of those worlds. Uh-huh. That's my jam. You've written a lot of really important articles, and I think you have a really great social media presence as well. And you have a book coming out later this year or next year?
Next year. The book is called, it was just re-entitled, The Sex Book, Myths, Positions, Taboos, and Possibilities, and it's being released by Disinformation Books. And yeah, that'll be out next year. It's sort of a tour through the history, politics, science, economics, et cetera, of sex, and where we sort of got things wrong to land on the attitudes towards sex we have in Western culture today, and maybe how we can do things a little better.
Oh my God, incredible. The history and where we're at, and also, like we were just talking about, suggestions for how to make change.
Right.
that's incredible. I can't wait to read it.
Thanks.
The disinfo book, Everything You Know About Sex Is Wrong, total root for me. Like, I remember finding it in City Lights Books in San Francisco a really long time ago and being like, I want to do that. I'm like, this is completely changing the way I think about this. Like, this is confirming everything that I always suspected about that.
Right.
So they're great.
They're like really good. Them. Yeah, they're really good for that. I mean, they totally changed my life too. And, you know, they sort of like, I don't want to say they faded away exactly, but they had like this moment, right? Which was like a huge moment. And like a huge countercultural moment, and now it's sort of more of a undergroundy kind of thing. But that actually, like, it seems like a good place for them to be, and I'm glad to, and right. I'm glad to be there with them in it. Yeah, I mean, it just all their countercultural stuff, from that sex thing to, you know, the most important book they ever put out for me was this book called The Book of Lies, which was this occult book, and it was so profound and. For me, it's just so bizarre. But, you know, there's nothing, like, yeah, they do this sort of, like, tongue-in-cheek thing, like, exploring crazy conspiracy theories and stuff.
Right.
But they're also just very serious. Like, they try to take things that you would sort of dismiss out of hand very seriously. Like, what if these crazy things are true, you know? Instead of just sort of a joke about it, you know? There are a few other publishing companies that do that. Like, Feral House, I think, does that, and Akashic, like, they just take these countercultural currents very seriously. And I think it's awesome.
Yeah, I think it's important. And I do think that with sexuality, it's extra important because there's a lot of disinformation about sexuality. And I mean, that's part of the reason that it can continue to be endlessly explored. And no one is ever going to be tired of having sex or talking about sex or analyzing it. Although I had a conversation at the retreat this week where people were saying, oh, people don't want to have their fetishes explained to them. That's a boner killer. And I was like, whoops, that's the whole premise of my podcast / the whole premise of my work. But I really don't believe that.
Yeah, I don't believe it either. In fact, I think probably one of the most pernicious myths about sex is that you're not supposed to think about sex, or that sex is anti-intellectual.
Right.
And I find that so, like, I think that is the most, like, hallmark, like, if there's a hallmark version of sex, like, that's it. It's like this capitalist construct that, like, when you have sex, you're supposed to be completely immersed and, like, connected, and you're not supposed to think at all. But, well, that's one type of sex. It's not really the sex that most people have.
Yeah.
Which is, like, you know, you're getting banged from behind and you're like thinking about, like, oh shoot, I can't forget to, like, go to the pharmacy tomorrow and get, you know, make sure I do laundry and blah, blah, blah. Like, thoughts enter your mind, you know, or like, what does my hair look like? Am I doing, you know, does this blowjob make me look fat or whatever, you know, like, just like whatever, you know, like all these thoughts enter your mind. And so, like, sex and thought are like, go together all the time, but it's, we're told that it's supposed to be totally immersive. And then when it's not, because we're told that, we feel like, oh, well, I want something deeper. I guess that must be what it's like to have sex with someone you're really in love with. So, and then, you know, much to your chagrin, you realize that, like, you're still thinking when you have sex with people you love, and, you know, and so.
Well, and also that's
fertile ground for, or sort of, to mix metaphors, it like opens the door for feelings of inadequacy and insecurity and guilt and shame, which are like ready to come rushing in.
Totally.
And
be manipulated by people and institutions in power.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you should buy this thing to create that feeling. You should. Right. Yeah. I mean, that's mostly it.
Right. Or you have to get drunk before you have sex. Like, right. Or you have to get drunk even to talk to people, like to initiate sex. Or you have to be in love if you're going to have sex, or like intoxicated with love, or, you know, and it's just like, no, you can just think during sex and about sex and it's fine. So, I mean, I think that there's some value in like having an immersive sexual experience. I just think that it's privileged over all kinds of sexual experience, and it's in fact very rare, and it's not necessarily better.
Absolutely. Well, I agree with that, and I'm sure that there's going to be a lot of that kind of stuff in your book and your writing in general. But let's go back to what you were saying about what disinfo, a lot of what disinfo does with the occult. Mm-hmm. So, when I lived in London, I was good friends with a guy named Jason Louvre who worked for, and I'd seen that he had interviewed you.
Yeah.
That was a weird connection of worlds, or not that weird, I guess. Jason has a book out, called Generation Hex through disinfo, and he introduced a lot of ideas about the occult and a lot of ideas of how sex and magic might go together, and ritual and sex might go together. And a lot of it, honestly, nerdily enough, was my touchstone for that was Grant Morrison's Invisibles series.
Yeah,
and
totally.
Grant Morrison also works for disinfo,
yeah,
or has done in the past. I'm, you know, basically with Jason, he was kind of like, oh yeah, all that stuff in that comic that you really loved when you were a teenager is totally real. So I'm just wondering, so I guess that was the connection that I made when I realized that was a part of your world as well, or, mm-hmm. Or you were a part of that world, when I was first sort of becoming familiar with your stuff, and I saw you'd been interviewed by Jason and talking about that. And so I guess that's as good enough a place to start as any. I'm really curious about your relationship to first of all, what is your definition of the occult?
Oh gosh. That's so funny. I've never been asked that before. So
it
let me
stumble through definition.
An answer. Yeah, I mean, I think it's only, I think the occult, let's put it this way, the occult is when you become aware of the stuff that's happening to you all the time anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just sort of a level of awareness about experience, you know, like, I think everybody goes through initiation and enlightenment and weird shit in their lives, right? But the occult is like, if you're engaged with the occult, you're just sort of aware of some of the weirdness, or aware of the initiation, or aware of the enlightenment happening, or aware of like whatever. But it happens to all of us in our lifetimes anyway, you know. So I think the occult is sort of a level of awareness, which, you know, I mean, occult means hidden. So I think it's like, once you know something is hidden, it's not hidden in the same way anymore.
Yeah, and you can show other people the way to the hiding spot.
Right. Or even if you don't know where the hiding spot is, knowing that it's hidden means that you know that it's there.
Right.
If it's just hidden, you're not even aware of its existence.
Right.
Right? So most people who are involved in a cult just know that there's something there. And then once you get through a certain amount of practice, you might be able to say, start identifying these something more tangible, something you can, or intangible as it were, like something that's that you can start talking about it in a more aware way, you know.
Yeah.
But the first step really is just knowing that things are not as they seem always, you know.
Yeah, what an exciting idea. And how did that first become a part of your life?
Who knows? Like, I mean, I was always into it. I was raised a spiritually,
mm-hmm.
my father is from a village in the mountains of Syria, so he was maybe a little Christian, some supernatural gypsy stuff mixed in there, probably. My mom was raised by religious fundamentalists. Neither of them had any inclination to take their children to church. So I was somehow still, nevertheless, always interested in religion and spirituality and my imaginative landscape and whatever lived there. And so, you know, I was a kid and I found this book called Curses, Hexes, and Spells, which I still have. I stole it from my school library. Who knows why that was there? And I did all this like black magic stuff when I was a kid, like with that book. It was like these fumbling attempts that I still sort of regret doing in a weird way.
It's interesting.
And
you think you like opened something up that you never closed again?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it's like it's that kind of stuff leaves like these doubts, like. Did I create a little bit of a scar on my being, or was I just a kid doing this dumb stuff? And who knows? You know?
Yeah.
It's like anything. I mean, when you're a kid, it's like your consciousness is not fully descended in the same way as it is, you know, when you're an adult. So it's like, do you blame kids for what they do or not? You know, like, do you hold yourself responsible? Was that just part of my karma? Like, whatever.
Well, whatever you experimented with then had to happen for you to get to where you are now.
Absolutely. And it's sort of like, I mean, I don't stress about it too much. You know what I mean?
You seem very relaxed.
but I think about those times, like, why was I into that stuff? Like, why was I into it as a kid? You know, really, really strange. You know, you can ask why and give yourself an answer up to a certain point, but then it's like, there was something going on with my, you know, what my being that I was supposed to be interested in that.
Yeah, I mean, I look back and I wonder, you know, why I was into Ani DiFranco when I was a kid. But I'm sure it helped in some way.
Totally. I think, yeah, like with any question of aesthetics, like you trace it back far enough and it just becomes a mystery. You know, it just fades into the horizon. Yeah.
So you had this book and you were, you know, dressing in black and lighting candles and
close enough
listening to metal. And
yeah, I was much younger. I mean, I was like 10 or something, and I'd been interested before then too, in a weird way. Like I'd always sort of been interested in like mysterious beings and monsters and that kind of stuff. As I got older, you know, there were some other sort of touchstone moments for me. But even, you know, my first memory is this sort of weird occult memory. And my first memory is a memory of a dream. And in the dream, I was eaten by a fox who was eaten by a wolf who was eaten by a bear. And I was inside the bellies of, like, it was like if you cross-sectioned them, you could see them almost in this, like, strange Native American mosaic-looking thing. Like, you could see the insides. And I woke up from that dream and ran, sort of tottered down the hall to my parents' bedroom. And, I mean, I must have been, like, 2 or 3. Wow. Like, so the first thing I remember is waking up from a dream of being inside of animals. and so, I mean, even, like, when I look at that, I'm like, that's weird. Like, it's weird that it was a dream. It's weird that that was the content. It's weird that that's, you know, I mean, this is the first thing I could remember. I mean, maybe I hadn't viewed that as an occult thing my whole life, but looking back, it just seems very strange.
Yeah.
You know? Although I suppose everyone's first memory feels sort of dreamlike and strange. So as I got older, you know, yeah, just sort of accumulating experiences and interest, and it just sort of just kept building and building.
Did you experience skepticism from people around you, or internalized skepticism in like how did that form your development? Because I'm sure that I mean, in general, I think that people would be confused by that, or even put off by that. I'm certainly not, but I'm just curious what you may have encountered in that.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting now that I think about it, since you ask. It's like, No, I grew up in small town Pennsylvania. Everybody was religious. So they believed there was some reality to it. You know what I mean? They might have thought that it was wrong.
Right.
They might have thought it was immoral, but they thought that it was real. And I think that that's part of, like, the sort of blessing of growing up around a lot of religious fundamentalists. It's like, you get to take shit seriously. I mean, they weren't fundamentalists, but I'm just saying in general. I mean, there were just a lot of Catholic churches and Protestant churches and stuff in my town. And, you know, in high school, too, I think kids really take it seriously. I think kids know it's, like, why they use a Ouija board or why they play right. Light as a Feather, Stiff as a Board or why they do Bloody Mother Mary or whatever. Yeah, it's like... Yeah. You have this real deep feeling for the supernatural when you're a kid,
yeah.
Up until a certain point, and by extension, the occult, and that might just be religious or whatever. But I think you're just in touch with it, even because we say that that's true for little kids, but I think it's true for teenagers as well.
It definitely is true. Well, you're also, I mean, just as a teenager, you have more agency and more control, and you're pushing against it,
right?
And experimenting, like we were just talking about, and you have a little bit more power and self awareness than you did when you were younger. So you're maybe pushing against the limits of that in a more self conscious way.
Totally, and I think even like people who might be inclined to be atheists or whatever, maybe because they had a fundamentalist upbringing or whatever, like when they're at that age, they still want to believe in some of it. Like they still want to like scare their friends with ghost stories or tell them about some weird experience. Like there's an excitement about it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas as you get older, either it doesn't happen or there's a sort of dismissal of it. Like, oh, there must've been an explanation or whatever. And I think that's because as you get older, your individuality is more solidified. And in that sense, the rest of the world is sort of blocked off more and more, which is a really amazing and profound and beautiful thing, but it requires then some effort to access that other sort of realm of your life, that imaginal realm.
So how is that connect? So how is your relationship to the occult related to your relationship to sex?
So, I mean, in lots of ways, you know, I don't do sex magic stuff. I've never really been interested in it, oddly. Like, it would seem like a no-brainer for me, but right. I've just never, like, sex itself seems so powerful. It's like, why am I don't need to add extra, like, shit to it. Like, it seems like its own mystery to me that, like adding this, bringing this dimension in, it's like, if I actually just look at what's happening, you know, as I do it, that's a weird enough experience unto itself, you know?
How would you define sex magic?
Well, sex magic, I think, is like... First of all, it's not totally true that I never did sex magic. Well, I'll get back to that in a second.
Okay.
But like,
I'll remember that.
Okay. I was just realizing as I said that how disingenuous that was. But I've not really been seriously interested in it in a way that someone might expect.
Right.
Sex magic is like... Yeah, harnessing the energetic power of sex to either sort of learn about the universe, in other words, to do some sort of divining thing, or to create change in your world, or to attract things to you, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I think sex always does that anyway. I mean, everything does that anyway. It's just whether you're aware of it or not.
Right.
Some people do ritualistic things around sex to make that more obvious to them. I have done sex magic in the sense that, like you, Grant Morrison was a really important sort of magical figure for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would do these sigils, like,
right.
where he would advise creating this magical symbol and empowering it with this sort of strange mental space of an orgasm.
Right.
Interestingly enough, the first sigil I ever did, in knowing that that's what it was called, I'd done some things when I was a kid, like some rituals that were kind of similar, just sort of fumbling through on my own. But when I sort of learned about it, I saw Grant Morrison do this demonstration on Disinfo, you know, conference or whatever.
I think I've seen that.
Right?
Yeah.
So I did it that day, and my sigil was to meet Grant Morrison. then I did like a month later, like, and suddenly I was at this disinfo conference in New York State, and it was me and it wasn't a lot of other people. It was like 20 or 30 people just hanging out with Grant Morrison and Doug Rushkoff and Richard Metzger and Howard Bloom and Paul Loffoli for the weekend.
Wow, I'd like to be a fly on the wall for
experience. It was profound. I mean, it was absolutely profound. And I, you know, forged some friendships, not with Grant, but with Doug and Richard, because of that. And that was a long time, you know, that was 2002 or something like that. I can't remember the exact year. So that was the first sigil I ever did. And then I met him. So I was like, wow, well, that's confirmation. You know? Cause I was like, how am I ever possibly going to meet this dude from Scotland? And then suddenly I saw an ad for him speaking in New York State when I lived, you know, in New England. So it was pretty awesome.
And I just want to sort of describe a little bit for our listeners who may not be familiar with what the concept of a sigil is, that and I definitely also learned it from Jason Louv and then who sort of directed me to Grant Morrison's presentations, and I actually think there's a chapter on it in that
in Generation.
Oh yeah, but also in Everything You Know About Sex Is Wrong. I'm pretty sure that that Grant like sort of like lays out how to do it. So basically, like, if you have an intention, like, you know, like, I want to meet Grant Morrison, and, you know, long story short, you make a sort of obscure symbol, you, like, construct a symbol out of the language, and then, during masturbation, during sex, like, during the moment of orgasm, you, like, concentrate on the image that you've made, and that's the sigil, and it is supposed to, you know, cast the spell out into the world, like using the consciousness of orgasm and the power of orgasm, and you can spin around until you're dizzy. You know, you don't have to have an orgasm, but, like, you know, if that's one of the options, it sort of seems like that would be the one to do.
Totally.
But it can be any kind of meditative state, is my understanding. And you know, I definitely first heard about that when The Invisibles was coming out and Grant Morrison was really sick, and he asked all of his fans to, you know, masturbate and cast a sigil to keep the comic going, and they did, and to save his health, I think, as well. Uh-huh. Anyway, again, with the stuff that that captivated me when I was younger as fiction, and then, you know, the wonderful thing about getting older and realizing, oh, there's something to that. It, you know, it's sort of counter of what you were saying before of getting older and becoming more skeptical and more closed off. It's nice to see the lines between fiction and reality be blurred more as we get older. But anyway, so you did something like that, and then you got to meet Grant Morrison, and and have you continued to do that kind of thing since?
No, I don't really do magic in that sense anymore. Yeah. You know, I mostly, if I do magic, it's sort of heart magic in a sense of, you know, something that, so the most important spiritual thinker to me is this guy Rudolf Steiner, and we can talk about him if you'd like.
Yeah.
But his message, it's sort of a maxim, right? Which I think a lot of occultists forget, or don't know about, or don't think about. I certainly didn't. So I'm not blaming anybody for not. But he said, you know, for every step in occult knowledge we gain, we must take three to improve our personalities. So it's like, I do a lot of just like trying to be a better person now, because, you know, I understand a lot about the occult and sort of how the world plays itself out in a way. And I'm kind of trying to catch up to that and not be an asshole to people, not be vindictive or jealous or angry or unforgiving or, you know, resentful, whatever. So it's like, because this knowledge is so powerful that when it starts coming through you, it's really important to have sort of a clear lens through which that, you know, is going to be projected into the world.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you just become this, like, either actually powerful and horrible, or not really powerful but totally deluded person. And so
I know a lot of both of those kinds of
people. Right, totally. Yeah. Well, we you know, like, we don't even have to bring the occult into it. I mean, you know, people that write a beautiful book or like a really important book about culture and then like are just monsters to other human beings, right? So like you're like, God, this book is so great, and you meet the person and they're just like treat other people like shit.
Oh, it's like that in music, absolutely, too. Yeah. Or any other kind of
totally
of cultural creation.
Yeah. And it can't, it just can't, it just doesn't do what it's supposed to do if it comes through, you know, a dirty lens, or dirty, but you know what I mean, lens.
So you were talking about heart magic and the just the importance of being a good person. I mean, it's in some ways it can be easier said than done, right?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's, I think the task of people that are engaged in the occult, and I know people are going to, I know people will disagree with this, but it's fine.
That's good.
I'm happy to have them disagree.
I love disagreement.
Is become a better, a kinder, more compassionate person. That's it, really. That's the bottom line. But if you want to do other occult stuff while you're at it, become a better, kinder, more compassionate, more loving person while at the same time doing your occult work. Divorcing the two, thinking that they're somehow separate, I just think does no good for anybody. I mean, after all, why do you even want to be involved in the occult? Like, you know, I mean, some people will say, well, I want power, or I want to know the truth, or, you know, whatever. I want to stop, like, environmental degradation, like some cultists are, you know, and neo-pagans and stuff are into that sort of thing. But it's like, yeah, but it really is about the human being.
But I mean, it also, I mean, I'm just really trying to think about this objectively in terms of what attracts people to it. It's also sexy.
Huh.
I mean, I think why is it sexy? It's sexy because it's mysterious. It's sexy because it seems dark. Some people are attracted to darkness.
Mm-hmm.
It obviously does not have to be dark. But I feel like there are a lot of, in America anyway, a lot of cultural associations with a sort of like a dark aesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it has a lot of potential for power, and I love your description of the ultimate importance of it being to be a better person. But I feel like there are a lot of sort of, when I think of the archetype of an occultist, I sort of actually think of somebody who's like a little bit more like an aloof rock star kind of like Byronic kind of persona. But maybe I just don't know enough white wizards.
well, Grant Morrison's a great example. I mean, it's like when he talks about his sort of like near-death experience that you had mentioned before when he was sick, he had a vision of Jesus Christ, right? Who said, like, you can live, but you gotta be good, you know?
Yeah.
And I need to refine that. It's not be good, it's do good. Because be good is ego. Do good, not that there's anything wrong with the ego, like, I actually think the ego is great, but do good is about something else than be good. So, like, so he has this vision of Jesus Christ saying, like, do good, you know, and he's like, okay. Yeah. And so he goes and he does all this, like, he's trying to figure it out. I mean, David Lynch is another example of someone who's,
a
white magician in the sense that he starts, he does the most incredibly dark and in some aspects the best portrayal of evil of any person ever.
That's absolutely true.
Right? But he creates these, like, schools, you know, like, for kids to learn meditation and become calmer, more peaceful, all that kind of stuff. So it's like, so you can still have that sexy, chaotic, crazy part, but while you're doing good. I mean, it's like, those are a great example. I mean, I think maybe she's fallen out of fashion a little bit, but Marina Abramović is another great example of someone. You know, I mean, these people who are involved in the occult but doing these powerful, well-known artistic things, I mean, those are, a lot of those people are what you would easily call white magician, and they're having profound effects on culture.
Well, yeah, I've read a little bit of David Lynch's work on transcendental meditation. What is the name of his book? It's like a coffee table book.
Oh, it's about like something about fish. Yeah, I forget.
Something about it. Yeah, I can't remember either. It was my like back of the toilet book for years because it's perfect. You like open it up and you read this little vignette. Anyway,
I hate that we don't remember. I hate when people don't remember the titles of books and they mention them because I'm like, God, if I were the author of that book, I'd be so bummed right
now. You know what, though?
He's David Lynch.
He's David Lynch, so if you Google David Lynch meditation book, he's totally doing fine. But the thing that I found really fascinating about what he said in that book, I've always loved David Lynch movies, and I've always been very aware that there is something completely unique to his movies that it's so rich with symbolism, and at the same time, it defies deconstruction. Mm-hmm. You know, there's never one meaning to an ear in the grass or mm-hmm. a, you know, red room or, you know, anything, mm-hmm. anything like that. You know, it has this like very particular obscurity to it. And reading him talking about meditation and talking about how meditation makes it so that, he's just in touch with his instinct. So when he's creating, He just knows. He knows that something needs to be a certain way in order to tell the story that he wants to tell. And the proof is in the pudding, because the things that he makes are completely, difficult to understand and yet completely engaging at the same time.
Right. That's, like, when you say that, just reminds me, like, they're alive. I mean, I think it's just that's the quality of it. It's it's wild because it's living. Like, you know, just like a person is unpredictable and layered and, you know, he's created something that feels like it, as if it has its own life. And indeed it does.
And so much, stuff about sexuality in those movies as well.
Totally.
So going back to, so you were talking about heart magic, and you were talking about Rudolf Steiner?
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that person. Okay. I'm not familiar with their work at all.
Okay, well, I have just shelves and shelves of his stuff over there. So Rudolf Steiner is a late 19th, early 20th century scientist, mystic, philosopher. He is responsible for creating biodynamic farming, Waldorf schools, community shared agriculture, a new form of beekeeping, architecture, a new font, a new system of medicine, he's just one of these people, very much like Leonardo da Vinci, much like Goethe, much like, there are just a lot of these people.
Yeah.
Newton, so on and so forth. And
we need more good fonts.
I know, right? Good fonts.
All that other stuff is important too, but really,
totally. Well, I love that movie Helvetica, where people are like,
"Oh my god,
this is the font of fascism." You know, I actually find Helvetica kind of pleasing, but I like the people that are raging against it. You know, the aesthetic of it. Anyway, so he, you know, his whole thing, which is called anthroposophy, is just, which means, you know, the divine feminine wisdom of man. He could have said human, but man sort of meant something different for a long time.
Sure.
And so his idea was that, like, look, everybody has the right to the occult, and it can find its way out of us in any field, in any place that we want. Like, you know, and, you know, you can be a banker and be an occultist banker. Like, how do you bring spiritual principles to banking? You know, how do you...
That's a good question.
You know? And he did a lecture series on economics. He did something like 6,000 lectures, had a bunch of books come out. So there were like three or 400 books altogether, like collecting his lectures and stuff like that. You can be in the government, and like, how do you create a spiritual government?
Yeah.
He was pretty close to, he sort of referred to himself. He said, if I have to, I'll call myself an anarchist, right? But he was not he believed in some form of government, but it was so estranged from government that you could barely call it that. And so, you know, his principle is just sort of like, let's spiritualize material and materialize spiritual stuff. Mm. And there are a lot of really important principles. So I'll just say four really quickly.
Yeah, please.
And we probably don't have time to go into all of them, but I'll just give sort of a quick sentence, which is, so the first is that thoughts are as real as objects. Mm. There's not a division really in the way that we think between the sort of thinking world, which we dismiss as fanciful illusion,
right,
and the material world. In fact, they're the same. Like, they're linked. They're not the same. They're distinct, but they're linked to each other. And the thoughts are as real, we need to take them as seriously as we do objects. And we need to create a worldview that regards thinking as part of the world, not just some sort of separate illusory dream aspect of the real, in quotes, material world. The second is that consciousness has evolved over time, meaning that the structure of consciousness has changed over time. So if you look at people who were in ancient Rome, the way they saw and experienced things was totally different than the way we experience things now. There's some overlap. But to believe that they just saw things that we did,
yeah,
yet they had different thoughts about them, is not correct. In fact, their entire system of perception, thinking, all that sort of stuff is different. And that's changed over time, and it's changed over time in different ways for different kinds of cultures.
Which maybe means that the texts created during that time prescribing behavior might be a little outdated.
Totally. Outdated and also misinterpreted by us who think, right, that it's supposed to relate to things in the way that we, you know. I mean, there's a famous example, actually, I think discovered by Goethe, who was a huge influence on Rudolf Steiner, who said, like, have you noticed that the Greeks never used the word blue for anything?
Whoa.
And then saying, so we could perhaps understand that they couldn't see that color.
Wow.
So what does that mean? So, yeah. So what we could get, we get deeper into that if you want, but then
that's very psychedelic.
right? So then the third is that, is that there is a spiritual landscape populated by spiritual beings. It's not just, you know, whimsy. Like, there's a real spiritual landscape populated by spiritual beings. And then the fourth is just freedom and compassion. Everybody deserves freedom. Everybody deserves compassion. And those are my four breakdowns. That's not like some official anthroposophical. That's how I break it down into 4 points. I think those are the four tenets of this system of being alive and thinking.
So is that, not have a one-track mind, but are those principles, which, yeah, you're right, we could fucking talk about that for the rest of our lives and all day, but are they connected to your sexuality or the work that you do, like your personal sexuality, but also the professional sexuality work that you do?
Yes. So the easiest one to identify is the last one, which is freedom and compassion, but in a radical occult way. So the first line in my book is, if you ever want to know how someone feels about freedom, start talking about sex. And the idea is, sex is so individualized. It is the most individualized thing ever. I sort of make an argument for this in the book, which I won't get into now, but it's like this nexus of where we were born, who our parents are, what our bodies are shaped like, what race we are, what our tendency toward orientation is, what are, you know, all these cultural factors. And then beyond the cultural factors.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Actors, there's all these sort of individualized predilections, these aesthetics, these things that we're interested in. And it's people interacting with other people. So it's this whole realm of humanity that's totally individualized. So as soon as you start getting down to this totally individualized level, let's see what you think about freedom. Like, do you really think individuals should be free? People have such a hair trigger response to different kinds of sexualities, even people who claim to be sex positive.
Right.
So that's how it sort of ties into that. How can we be compassionate for people that are utterly different? I mean, it works out in sexuality in a very obvious way. You and I walk down the street. I see some dude that I think is hot. And I'm like, wow, that guy's so hot. And you're like, ew, him? Like, you literally cannot enter into the world that's like creating this like stimulating action of desire in me. You just can't fathom it. It's totally alien.
I would never say that, by the way.
I know. Well, that's part of the training for like a new sexuality is like not shaming people for their tastes, right, or their desires. But I think that like and so people like you are and people who have thought about sex, you know not to do that, right? But
I try.
But right, me too. But sometimes I don't want to succeed.
But I'm being glib. But I also it totally just happened last night. Somebody said, "Oh, that person is really hot," and I felt compelled to say, I'm not attracted to that person. Right. In a way, it's especially when you're getting to know people, it's a way of defining yourself, you know, what, right. So that people know. And sometimes it has to do with gender, and you want someone to know, oh, that it might be the kind of person that I'm attracted to anyway. But
right. No, totally. I think there are lots of reasons why we do it.
Yeah.
I bring it up just to say that, like, when we see that someone's sexuality sexual orientation or orientation to sex is a better way to say it, is like totally foreign, totally different than ours, even though there might be similarities or cultural currents that run through everybody's, can we extend compassion to them even knowing that they're totally separate from us, knowing that they're totally alien? That's the real work of compassion. It's not like we're all one. It's you're totally different than me. You're a different universe altogether. Can I care about you anyway?
Yeah.
For that reason. Yes, exactly. Or for that reason. Can I put in the intentional effort of understanding? Yeah. And if I can't, can I put in the intentional effort of loving you anyway?
Yeah.
So that's where that principle plays out in sex, I think, is a radical individualism. As far as the other things go, well, thought and being as real as objects, I think that the trans movement is really showing us that a lot lately, which is, yeah. I think is great. It's like,
fuck yeah,
I'm not just this body. Like, fuck you. Like, this, there's something else present here. It's just a powerful other thing happening. Which, by the way, the occult has always said that. I mean, some occultists have missed it, but the occult has always said that male and female, well, masculine and feminine, might be these sort of universal cosmic principles, right? And maybe even a cosmic polarity, which may be changing right now. Maybe that law of nature is changing at this moment in time, but that everybody contains both.
Right.
So it's always said that, like, men have a female etheric body and vice versa.
Yeah.
And so, like, sometimes these things come closer together for people, sometimes they're further away from each other, but we all have these principles within us. So it's like, I think that the trans movement is making these powerful occult statements without even necessarily realizing it. And I know there are some trans atheist people that would just fucking hate that I'm saying this, but that's okay. Anyway, so I think that materiality aspect is being expressed by people who are talking about sex, gender, sexuality right now in a big way. I think also we can see that sex is not just the act of sticking a dick into a pussy or rubbing two clitorises together or, you know, all these things. Like, it's not just the material stuff. There's something else happening that's broader than our bodies And so I think that that's how it plays into that, in my view. And the other two, I can get into those too, but those are two examples of how they intersect.
I'm wondering, we were talking about consent a little bit before we turned the recorder on. This is like a huge question, but I love this first title of your, or the first sentence of your book about the relationship between freedom and sexuality, and a lot of your political writing around sexuality has explored that really succinctly. And I guess I'm wondering if you have an opinion about the relationship between freedom and consent when it comes to sexuality.
Yeah, you just want to throw me in the deep end
here. I do! Because I know you can, I know you've got big muscles, you can swim.
No, that's good. I love it, and it's something that I've been trying to figure out how to talk about publicly more, so this will be good.
I don't just want to ask you the same five questions, Connor.
No. Right on. So, where'd you get your porn name from?
Is that your real name?
Yeah, totally. How what are you going to do when you retire?
How did you get started?
What kind of guys are you into?
What do you have to do before you have anal sex?
Yeah, how does that work? Totally. So, so freedom, consent. Okay. So I think that the sex positive world has really latched onto this idea of consent as the sort of be all end all, right? It's the foundation of sexual ethics. Mm-hmm. I think it's a great and vital component. I'm going to repeat that. I think it's a vital component of sexual ethics. It's not enough. Why? Because consent has a terrible shadow side to it. First, the shadow side comes historically. You know, we don't really get to consent to what kind of consent culture allows us. So, you know, consent used to be defined by the church, right? Like, we'll be the ones who tell you what you can consent to. And what you really consent to is just a relationship with God in a certain way. That's everybody's right, is to consent to God in a certain way, but we're going to define what that means, right? Well, right now, at this moment, we have people who are certain feminists, certain feminists who say, well, you are you're not really consenting. You're saying you're consenting as sex workers.
Oh, God.
But you're not actually consenting to anything, right? Like, you're actually deluded. So we're going to define consent for you. Or you have neuroscientists, or you have evolutionary psychologists who are saying, yeah, you think you're consenting to stuff, but actually it's just this pattern of determined actions made up by matter and motion. So you're really not consenting. It's just an illusion. Everything is sort of... So, like, this idea of consent, it's like, where are you getting that idea of consent from?
I mean, it's about, like, free will and determinism, too, if we want to talk about philosophy. And...
Or you want to talk about psychology. Like... Yeah. Like, what we consent to, there's an aspect of what they're saying that's true that we need to heed, which is there's an unconscious. And sometimes we consent to things for terrible reasons. Sometimes we don't consent to things for terrible reasons. So what does consent mean? How is it defined? It's also defined by university manual codes of conduct so the people that work for the universities don't get sued.
Right.
It's all constructed, you know, in this other realm. And I think that we've seized on this idea because we somehow believe that it's really pure. But in fact, it's not. In fact,
like once you come to a certain understanding, there will be complete clarity over the judgment that you will be able to make about what is consensual and what isn't.
Absolutely. So the thing I go along with this idea of consent as a foundation of sexual ethics is if I say no, don't touch me, and I really mean this in the realm of physical contact.
Yeah.
If I say no, you don't get to touch me, then, or you don't get to touch me in that way.
Right.
The end.
Yeah.
Like, that's, you have to listen to that. I might be totally fucked in the head for saying that. I might actually want you to fuck me more than anything, and I'm saying no, but I've communicated no, so you're not allowed to. Like, that's, I agree with that part. And I think that that's everybody's right.
And that's sort of the most important material part of it.
Right.
Yeah, but anyway, then there's, in the interest of raising... having these conversations about consent so that less people rape is that's the principle of what it's all about, and it's gotten convoluted for reasons that you're describing. So go ahead.
Right. So do we want to extend the model of rape and sexual violence into places that are not related in the same way or related in a distinct way to sexual violence or rape or trauma or et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah.
And this is where it starts getting more complicated. So, for example, in San Francisco, you know, I went to this gym where guys would have sex in the steam room.
Yeah.
And for a really long time, for like 20 years at that gym, it just went on and everybody was cool with it. It was like, that's the gay gym. Dudes have sex in the steam room. You kind of know what you're getting into there, right?
Yeah.
Suddenly, straight people started moving into the neighborhood. The local politicians were much more interested in allowing, in inviting straight people into the Castro and inviting straight businesses, et cetera, et cetera. So this new culture started to filter in. And suddenly, the gyms panicked and closed the steam room.
Right, because so, also for 20 years, there was a culturally inherited understanding of cruising and yes. consent, where if you're like, I actually just want to pump some iron today, and somebody gives you the series of signifiers and you give the series of signifiers back, and then totally. Probably for the most part somebody just moves on to the next person who's their type that they want to blow in the steam room.
Right.
And if that's what you, if you want to pump iron and get a blowjob, if you want to just go there to, you know, suck dick, then it was all copacetic. I'm sure there were instances of non-consent or, you know, things that people were unhappy with during those 20 years, but in general it was functional.
Totally. And so it was functional historically, which is great. Like, you're talking about the difference of the cultural context, the understanding of the context. But then even beyond that, then people started complaining, I'm seeing people having sex in that steam room.
Right.
And that violates my consent.
Right.
Now, this is where things start getting to a place where I feel uncomfortable. I don't think we can have the same rules of consent for viewing something as we can for engaging in a physical way with something. This is very hard to talk about because I think that we as a culture need to push on the boundary of what we allow in the visual field, push on the boundary of what we allow other people unrelated to us to engage in sexually or even just to be naked in public.
Yeah.
Because, you see, we have these arguments, for example, of politicians in certain states saying that women aren't allowed to take their shirts off in public, but men are.
Right.
The only way for women to take their shirts off in public and make that legal is to violate what we consider consent at this point, is to say, I don't care if you want to see my breasts or not. I don't care if you think this is sexual or not. For me to have the same kind of freedom as a man, I need to be able to take my shirt off. So I'm going to do it in protest. That's the only way to make it happen. So we have
there's no way of doing it without being aware that there are going to be some people who either sexualize you or just have their attention drawn to you, and then it gets into the complicated question of asking for it. Like,
right.
if I take my shirt off, I'm female, I have breasts. If I take my shirt off in New York, where it's legal,
right.
in the park, and people stare at me, and I'm uncomfortable with that, like, you know, it's... I always think of it as, like, this is the sort of toll that I have to pay because, like, I want an even tan, or, like, I'm more comfortable this way, or, like, this is just what I want, or I want to exercise my freedom. But that gets really murky and complicated when we start to talk about other things in terms of asking for it, with regards to rape. And,
totally.
And even just with regards to how it can feel really oppressive to have people staring at your tits all the time.
Totally. Which they will, by the way, do whether you have a shirt on or not.
That,
right?
That may be true for others' tits more than mine. Okay.
Right. Well, which they may do whether you have a shirt on or not.
I understand what you're saying.
But,
yeah.
But be serious. So the thing that I want to say is, like, look, like, The problem with emphasizing consent over everything else, as vital as and important as it is if we don't examine, scrutinize, and question our own boundaries at the same time as supporting the concept of consent. Consent, what we can consent to and the kinds of consent we're allowed, diminish and become smaller and smaller and smaller, because the conversation about sexuality becomes a conversation only in the negative space of what our boundaries are and what we allow, what is tolerable only to us. So while I in no way believe that anybody should ever be able to touch or engage in a sexual act with an unwilling person, I think that we have the duty, as we support and proliferate this concept of consent, to examine our boundaries as well and understand and be responsible to our boundaries.
Fuck yes, absolutely. Yeah. I want to, it's another thing we could talk about all day. I want to talk, I want to come back a little bit to talking about occult stuff. So first of all, so we've talked a little bit about you. Mm-hmm. If people are curious about the occult, and we can have a recommended reading list or lectures to watch. But if people want to start bringing that into their lives, particularly into their lives with regards to sexuality, do you have some tools for starting?
Oh, in regards to sexuality?
Yeah.
The biggest tool I think you can do is masturbate and watch what happens when you masturbate.
Mm.
So create an observer self, not every time, because that's no fun.
Yeah.
To do it every single time, or maybe it is fun for you every single time, I have no idea, but to notice this weird thing, like, I'll speak to people who have penises, right? And who, penises that ejaculate. So, when you jerk off, you close your eyes, if you're not watching porn, you close your eyes and you create this, this series of images, imaginative images, while you're conducting a simple, repetitive physical motion.
See, this is a moment that I wish that this was video, so people could see you.
This is me doing the jerk-off motion. while doing a simple, repetitive motion, and by combining those things for about 3 to 7 minutes, whatever, half the substance that creates life comes erupting from your body. Now, this is very bizarre. We should stand back and see this as very strange. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Like, what? How's it? And then you notice, like, this world of bringing the imaginal world and the physical world together is very powerful and very strange. For people who have. I'm always sort of struggling to make sure I live up to the responsibility of talking about genitals and gender in the right way. But for people who have clitorises, for people who have what is typically considered female anatomy,
sure,
masturbating, it also has this quality, which is that we all have access to an altered state of consciousness whenever we want. At any time. Even people who can't touch their own genitals, like, they have access to an altered state of desirous conscious if they want to.
Yeah.
But I think that it's like, you have this, you have access to this. It's like, you know, people do hallucinogenic drugs all the time, and that's awesome, but, like, you can enter, like, a pretty bizarro world if you want, from compared to the waking world, if you masturbate.
Yeah.
So the first thing I would say is pay attention to this thing that's always available to you.
Yeah.
Do it more and just pay attention to what's happening. Where's your feeling going? Where's the rest of the room going? What kind of feelings are appearing in your body? Create a phenomenology of that. Create an observation of that.
How do you feel afterwards in terms of how you relate to other people and how you relate to your work and,
totally,
and how you relate to your body, and what happens if you don't masturbate for a period of time.
Experiment with it.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, do occult experiments. And Frankly, you can do that with anything. You can do that when you're reading a book. You can do that when you're walking down the street.
Sure.
It's creating a meditative, noticing part of, like, walking. But you asked me in relation to sex. So if you can't just have sex all the time, well, you can have a sexual act with yourself whenever you want.
Betty Dodson.
Yeah. All right. Totally. All right. While thinking of Betty Dodson, if you want to.
You can totally think of Betty Dodson getting fucked by a dog. Right. Anyway.
Why not?
That's what she would want.
That's, yeah, the dog would have wanted it that way.
So that's what Betty says.
Uh-huh.
And then what about, I love, because of Betty Dodson and for a million other reasons, I always love the empowerment of masturbation in the sense that, you know, whatever it is that we're talking about, that you always have the power to do that with yourself. And, you know, that's another cultural thing that I think causes a lot of inadequacy and mm-hmm. shame for all of us around sexuality, that, like, you got to find the right person to have that transcendent moment with, mm-hmm. that you have to find somebody, period. Anyway, so I love the idea of being able to make love to yourself and make magic happen. Mm-hmm. But I am curious, what are some ways that if you do have a friend that you can get naked with and experiment with all of these things? What are some things that you can do with somebody else?
Well, I think the first thing is, if you're really going to do something with someone else, you need to tell them about it and talk to them about it.
Yeah. Speaking of consent.
Yeah. I had a boyfriend once that I just decided I'm just going to do one little, like, magical thing with him and see, you know, and, it was the night, like, he lived in New York and, we were in San Francisco together, and it was a long distance relationship. And I, like, took some of my cum and I rubbed it on his wrist, and I, like, at the moment of, like, had my orgasm, I was like, I'm gonna give this to him, like, whatever it was I was thinking in the moment. And then I, like, put it, and that night he got home and he was so delirious that he left all his luggage outside his door, and he had these horrible nightmares the next day. This guy never really even remembered his dreams, like, in a serious way. Flipped out, had these horrible, like, and then, like, realized, like, he had left his luggage outside his house, like, or his apartment. Like, it was terrible. It was a terrible experience. And perhaps I had nothing to do with that, but I felt terrible about it. Yeah. You know, I think that it's possible that these kinds of things can have serious consequences, even though I was doing something for his benefit when I did it. Like, you know, like, it was a sort of healing kind of thing that I was doing, but I just had no right to do it. So I think, if first of all, talk to the person about it. And then I think, in some ways you're asking the wrong person, because I don't do this kind of stuff that often. But I think that they're, so I kind of feel a little badly giving advice. I mean, it sounds like you might know a few more things than I do.
Well, do you have any recommendations for people who might be able to tell the people more?
Oh, uh-huh. There's this guy, Donald Craig, K-R-A-I-G, and he writes a lot about sex magic. There's, like we've been talking about Grant Morrison, that's primarily masturbation, very simple breakdown. There is, if you want to really get to it, you can check out Aleister Crowley.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I think it actually might be something that I learned through Alan Moore, which wouldn't be surprising. But I have this image in my mind of Crowley talking about anal sex being the most powerful magic available to anyone. Is that right? Like, well, is that something that he... I mean, I know he liked to have lots of butt sex, but...
Well, there was, you're right, there's something, like, just him trying to convince other people, like, through that, but there is a certain, apparently, I don't know because I'm not in it, but there's a certain level of initiation in the OTO, which involves,
What's the OTO?
The OTO, it's like, it's just this sort of grand hierarchical order, you know, that stems from Crowley, but started before him. I might be getting this wrong, by the way. It might not be the OTO, but let's just say, okay, if you know who Crowley is, you will know where I'm wrong, and it's no big deal. If you don't know who he is, you'll look into the OTO and find out if I'm right or wrong, and it'll be great.
Yeah.
So anyway, there's a level of initiation, and that level of initiation involves getting fucked in the ass, right? And now, my view on that is, like, the really powerful thing about getting fucked in the ass, and why, in some senses, homosexual men have been so threatening to people in power, is, like, when you take the place that shit comes out of, and you reorganize and ritualize it into a place of pleasure, like, that's a pretty powerful transubstantiational, like, act. Like,
that's so fucking beautiful.
Right? Like, like, I'm turning this place that is supposed to be the most repulsive, disgusting thing on the human body, and I'm saying, fuck it. Actually, I'm going to lick that. I'm going to fuck it. I'm going to stick my hands in it. I'm going to look at it and be aroused. Like, all of that is this really, like, is this really powerful alchemical thing. And, you know, I mean, it's not like I think all gay men or all people who are partaking in anal sex are doing that consciously. But if you can become conscious of that, it's, you know, it's something pretty profound.
I mean, it goes back to something that I was actually thinking about when we were talking about consent, which is that part of what makes it murky is also that humans have the ability to use their imaginations to create scenarios of believing that there is non-consent present.
Right.
When there is actually consent, and ironically, because the consent is there, because the mutual respect is there, the sort of seemingly, like, literal acts of something repulsive, like shit, or something fearful, like rape, can be the most arousing and have the most potential for connection and compassion. And, you know, I mean, I look for, in my partners, the compassion enough to recognize that I want to be called dirty names, and I want to, you know, be thrown around, or I want to be, I want my ass beaten till it's black and blue, you know, or I want to be fucked in the ass, or any of those things. Like, you know, to the untrained eye on the surface, it looks like darkness, but it's actually freedom and compassion.
Right. That's, you've presented a definition of ritual, because that's all it is, right?
Right.
I'm creating a framework. Right? Here's a frame. I've created this, so obviously I've consented to it.
Right.
Once I walk into that frame, crazy stuff is going to happen. Yeah. Right? And I know I'm walking out of it. So it's like you bind it, you bind all that intensity in a space. It's like, it's just like someone drawing a pentagram on the floor, and something happens within that pentagram, as long as it's bound by the circle.
Mm.
Right? So, you draw it, the things happen in there, and then you step out of it, and there it is. And which is why, again, also why S&M, why all sorts of sexual acts are again also threatening to people who are in power,
right?
Because it's people getting training in ritual.
So
once you get trained in ritual, hey, when I step into this framework, you're going to be raping me.
Right.
I'm going to actually even be scared. I'm going to be thrilled. There's going to be moments where I'm like, is he really raping me?
Right.
Or is she really raping me? Like, or is this just a, but there's a little part of me, because this, I've done this framework, that's like going to come out of this space. Like that kind of toying with consent. Imagine if we applied that to money, or we applied that to thinking about the government, or we applied that to whatever. It's like, we suddenly understand that we're actually inside and not consenting to being inside a grand ritualistic system.
Oh, man.
So the more we create our own rituals, the more we start to see the ones that are all around us, the more we can step outside of those, and what a threat that is.
Fuck yes! We figured it out!
Yeah.
Okay. I think I think that's a wrap. I think we can talk about other things. I know we're getting a little short on time, but I feel really enlivened by that connection.
Awesome.
That's fucking that's the best.
Yeah.
One last thing that I wanted to ask you about is, it's like 2:45 right now. Is that
okay.
Cool? So,
yeah, that's fine.
So one last thing that I wanted to ask you about is, sort of like connected to this in terms of fiction and in terms of the ability to distinguish between fantasy and reality or fiction and reality, and just, I don't know, I guess I'm thinking about the connection between some of the metaphors for all of these practical occult things that we see in fiction. Like, I don't know if you've watched American Horror Story, but like anything like American Horror Story, anything like that's, you know, The X-Files, like anything that's fantasy or science fiction or horror, I've always been, you know, speaking of things that we've always been drawn to, like, I've always been drawn to these supernatural allegories. I feel like the realism that's there in the metaphor is so much more compelling to me than realism is.
Yeah, totally.
And I have been thinking a lot lately about how I feel like porn is like that as well. And that the... you know, when people get upset, you know, censorship, going back to your discussion of freedom, you know, when people censor things, it's usually, you know, really extreme imagery in fiction or really extreme imagery in hardcore sexuality. And I guess my question is, what do you think the function of those fantasy worlds are in culture, and why we create them, and why they're so threatening to the people who are making those big circles and trying to keep us unconsensually inside of them.
So what are the, you mean in porn particularly, or?
You're a porn performer, and I, you know, you think about porn, from time to time. So, so specifically about porn.
Well, porn's such a weird case, right? Like, porn is like porn is athletic, you know? Like, I'm going to get my body to do this thing. I'm going to be in it and not in it at the same time. I'm going to sort of arrange it in this way, right? Like, it's weirdly yogic, you know? Like,
yeah.
Like, you know, when you have to get fucked on a, like, as I have on a stationary but motorcycle, it wasn't moving, but still, it's tough. Like, when you have to get fucked on a motorcycle for like 3 hours, like, you learn a bit about what you can do with your body and what you can't do with your body and what your limits are, right?
It's also about creating a moment of connection while also cheating out.
Totally, right. Yes, totally. And then, yeah, and then, you know, like, you're acting, but you actually, at least in gay porn, you actually have an orgasm. You know, like, I'm not sure, you know, some women have orgasms when they're in porn and some don't. And you're sort of, like, entering into this fantasy role. Hi, I'm the doctor and you're the patient and I'm gonna fuck you. You know what I mean? Like, it's all this weird, like, all porn is, like, this weird cosplay stuff, you know?
Sure,
like,
sure.
So I think it's all that stuff. Now, I'm a little unsure. Are you asking me about what the viewer, what's threatening about people viewing that? Or are you asking me what's threatening about people doing it?
Well, I think that they're wrapped up together. I mean, the people who object to porn generally, you know, perpetuate stigma against the people who produce it, as well as the people who watch it, often hypocritically, right? There are many people who watch porn and then condemn the people who create that porn.
Right.
I guess it's just a general question about why do you think porn is something that people are so interested in censoring?
Yeah, well, I think there are two sides of it. And the one side is, on the one hand, whenever people legislate against sex, including porn, it's very often not about sex itself, right? Like, I think a lot of the stuff that's happening with porn right now and porn censorship and all that, you know, especially in the UK, is about people in power trying to control the internet in general.
Right.
So they use porn because they've also created a culture where people have very hair trigger responses to anything with sexual content or sex whatsoever. So using porn as a sort of canary in the mine to be able to control other stuff, I think that's there. On the other hand, I think there's a side that sex has power in and of itself, which is threatening. So if you have people experiencing with the landscape of their desires and it becomes so normalized that you have, like we did in ancient Rome, frescoes of people fucking painted on living room walls next to like whatever else, and it's not a big deal, and there are like mugs with penises as the handles and all that kind of stuff, and sex just sort of, and it becomes normalized, well then first of all, we're more cognizant of our of the access that we have to a certain kind of power, which are the sorts of power that we talked about before. But then also, so we gain power, a certain access to a certain kind of power. And then the flip side is the people had been using that to manipulate us in certain ways lose access to that power, because it's just like them telling us, don't eat, we're not gonna let you have food anymore, which also they're doing
with Soylent,
with Soylent, well with soy for that matter, with every GMO fake food product that we've been experiencing since, you know, a little before World War II,
right?
Which, by the way, some of those have links to sexual repression, which is another interesting story.
I can't wait to read that article.
I know. Well, if you've ever heard of someone saying moral fiber, well, that comes from Kellogg and Post, creating anti-sex cereals to heal people from the wounds they'd inflicted with themselves with masturbation.
Oh my god, that movie, The Road to Wellville. That was there. Anthony Hopkins. Do you know it's about it? Anthony Hopkins plays Kellogg.
Yes, I've heard about it.
And it's about his. Yeah, I just remember. Yeah.
So there's this interesting
like fisting like doctors who are, you know, curing you know, consumption with fisting. I don't even know. But yeah, it's a bizarre movie. There's a lot of famous people.
Well, I really want to see it. I've never seen it. I've heard about it though.
Yeah.
But I think that there's like, anyway, it's
moral
like
moral fiber. Fuck, man.
Yeah. So if you have like people who are like, so anyway. The people in power lose power. The people who aren't in power or who could be gain power, gain access to power, and things start sort of evening up a little bit. And so I think that's the other side. So on the one hand, it's not really related to sex at all. On the other hand, it's totally related to sex. So, yeah.
Yes. Oh, my God. Yeah, the last time that I interviewed you and the last time we talked, you were saying that you were on, like, a little bit of a hiatus. Are you still on a hiatus from performing?
A porn hiatus? Yeah, I'm kind of what I refer to as porn fat right now, which just means that by the standard of the companies I work for, I have a belly and it's not...
Like, oh, man.
I wouldn't feel right going on to set for most of those companies right now. But also, I've just been so busy with other things. I am now the vice president of the Adult Performer Advocacy Committee. So,
which is so amazing.
Yeah, I'm totally psyched. So that's, I have a meeting tonight actually. So that's how I'm staying involved right now. I definitely want to make more movies. It's just, you know, like the funny thing about being in porn is like, you can never, like if you do too much, you're overexposed. If you don't do enough, you're retired. Right. It's like, no, I'm not overexposed or retired. I'm just like doing my own thing. And when I do some porn, I'll do some porn. Like just because I'm not doing 5 a month, like I did like 3 years ago or whatever, you know, I mean, I would have like 10 movies coming out in a year and people would be like, are you retired? And I'd be like, no, I think it's retired is a ridiculous term for something that's usually not someone's primary job.
Yeah. It's a reflection of stigma too. I think like going back to what you were joking about where people are like, so when are you going to get a real job?
Yeah.
Like,
Okay.
So now you've come to your senses and you stopped doing that.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, what kind of guys are you into, Connor?
guys that just totally think I'm cute.
So you have a lot of options.
I like everybody. I mean, I don't like everybody, but I'm I know it when I see it kind of guy, which is actually an effect of being in porn. Like once you get paid to have sex with the people that everybody supposedly says are attractive,
right.
You suddenly like start refining your own taste because you're like,
I had that experience.
Really?
Definitely. Yeah. It was much more like a sense of discernment. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it was like, what are you gonna like? You know, someone trying to impress me with their abs or like how big their dick is. It's like I've had bigger. I've seen like more abs on someone than you have. Like, it's not going anywhere for me. Like, sometimes it might, but that's part of a whole thing. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's not like I'm never attracted to big dicks or, you know, ripped abs, but it's like, it's definitely not, it's just what I want.
So there's hope out there for the guys with the big dicks and ripped abs.
You still have a chance, perfectly chiseled, handsome, big dicked, rich dudes. Like,
okay, that's great. They're not going to cry themselves to sleep tonight. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast. You're brilliant and beautiful.
Thank you.
And
thank you so much.
And yeah, I can't wait to see what more comes out of you.
And if you want to see more that comes out of me, it's just go to my Twitter. It's just @ConnorHabib. I have a website, which is ConnorHabib.com, but I'm changing it right now. I think it just leads you to my blog right now. So, yeah.
And the book, the sex book.
Yeah.
Comes out from Disinfo in 2015.
Yeah. Isn't it weird that there were no other books of note with that title? Like, or no, like really books that had done really well. I was shocked when they chose the title and I was like, there's gotta be something. But then I looked and there was nothing.
I mean, we live in a Google age now, honestly, where like you want to just, when people say sex, it's actually quite brilliant. It's better than being obscure.
I know.
Because then people are gonna find you. Yeah.
I know, totally.
Awesome. Oh, well, I can't wait to read it.
Thank you. It was so great talking to you.
Yeah, you too. I thought I knew the meaning of love.
Into That is produced and hosted by Tina Horn. Our theme song is by Pine from Oakland, California, and our website was designed by the one and only Justin Levesque. We are exclusively sponsored by Smitten Kitten, who you can visit at smittenkittenonline.com. Thanks for downloading or streaming episode 14. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Into That Podcast. And at Tina Horn's Ass. Please subscribe on iTunes as if you were completely under my power. And take a second to give us a rating or a review. I'm Tina Horn, and if you need me, I'll be starting the revolution with butt sex. Till next time.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.